The Shortcode Podcast is a proud member of the MedEd Media Network. Inspiration, information, and guidance on your journey to medical school and beyond at mededmedia.com.
Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcode Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews
by students for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
Welcome back to the Shortcoat Podcast, a production of the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. I'm Dave Etler. As you know, listeners, organization is key to what we do in medicine and medical education. For instance, every time I prepare for the show, I have a procedure that I follow to ensure that everything goes smoothly, from picking topics to writing for the show. Literally everything I do has a logical, orderly series of steps. For instance, I have 5 microphones to use, which means that I have 4 medical students co-hosting with me every week. So I have to be careful to ensure that my prescribed sign-up procedure is fair and reliable and no one gets shafted. You'll see the fruits of my strict adherence to exacting procedure with my 6 co-hosts, which was not at all the result of me doing it wrong. Listeners, say hello to Levi Endelman.
Hello.
Laura Quast.
Hi.
Kylie Miller.
Hi, guys.
Irene Morquende.
Hey.
New co-host, hopefully, Kaylin Campbell.
Howdy.
And I think Casey McCleary will be joining us in a little while. She probably got stuck on the wards. You know how that is. Anyway, thank you all for joining me. Thank you for putting up with my foibles as organizer of this shit show. That's it. Got nothing for me? No reaction?
Oh, us? I was just trying to
look. What do you mean us? You guys are the co-hosts.
I was trying to look at the script so that I could see how you spell foibles.
I did not.
You didn't write foibles.
I didn't write foibles. So I do ad lib, you know. I want to start off the show today by congratulating our federal government.
I thought you were going to say me for
no,
something.
Is there anything I should congratulate you for?
Making it
made it to second year.
All right. So. Congratulations.
Thank you.
To all of you. You guys are all second years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, congratulations to you for getting to your second year.
Yay.
I'm glad that you're still here. But congratulations to the federal government, which has finalized an agreement between it and pharmaceutical company Mylan on penalties to be paid by the EpiPen maker for overcharging Medicaid by improperly classifying the brand name drug as a generic medication. So here are the terms. You tell me. Mylan will pay a penalty of $465 million to be divided up among all 50 states as a result of squeezing Medicaid programs for $1.27 billion, as determined by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office of the Inspector General. Anything you want to say about that deal?
I have a question. Why did they not have to pay back the full amount? Why are we eating that?
Yeah. Oddly, that was our own Senator Chuck Grassley's question. it's only a third of the amount that they bilked Medicaid for. Not only that, but here's another detail. Rival drug company Sanofi tipped off the feds to Mylan's deception in the first place, and they will get an additional $38.7 million. As some sort of reward, plus some of the state's recovery. Feds, they're excellent negotiators.
You know what they say, though, snitches get stitches. Or $38 million.
Yes. So good job, federal government. Glad to have you on our side. I do have a listener question from Terrell. Shall we hear from Terrell?
Yes.
All right, here we go.
What is the difference between a hospitalist and an internist?
Ooh.
Well, as far as I understand, the hospitalist is the one who admits people. Mm-hmm. Like, as the ER doc, I would call him up and go, hey, this guy's really sick. I need him to go to a room. And then the hospitalist would evaluate him or tell me that there are no beds and that he is going to have a really long night in the ER. And then the hospitalist would be the one to like do the initial workup. And then maybe it would go like internist. I don't know. They throw that word around a lot.
I've
my understanding has been, just from what little I read about it, is that hospitalists are a little bit more broad. Like a hospitalist might practice multiple specialties within something like, you know, adult medicine or pediatrics, but all kind of related to internal medicine, whereas the internists are what you think more of like your hospital, like your internal medicine doctors, your specialists, but, you know, they each have their niche, but I really don't know.
I think that's more of what I've heard too.
Okay.
Yeah. Your internal medicine doctor has to do a residency in internal medicine. Your hospitalist doesn't, like you kind of alluded to, Levi. And internal med can practice inpatient or outpatient, but like hospitalists don't have practices outside of the hospital traditionally. And they have really weird schedules. So your hospitalist can be on for a month and off for a month. Or usually I think it's like a week, on for 1 week, 7 days, just living at the hospital, and then they're off for 7 days. So they manage a lot of your patients on the medicine floor, and then like correctly consult with patients that kind of are outside their scope, like specialty consults. But
all right, I hope we helped you out there, Terrell. We also have some listener feedback on our episode on mental illness in medical school, and on Casey, Innie, Jason, and Ipar's experiences. They were the hosts of that show. It was a couple of weeks ago that we re-released that episode. I accidentally released it at double speed while I was on vacation.
Someone did have a medical student of you.
Yeah. Well, you know, I should have hidden behind, you know, like, well, I did it for you.
You know what I did this summer?
What?
I desperately wanted to double speed everything I watched on Netflix or Hulu.
Yeah.
Not endorsing those or anything, but
yes.
Everything that I watch, even people, I'm like, we're having this conversation. I'm like, can I double speed you? Like, where's the button?
It's somebody asked me, they downloaded the podcast that was at 2x speed, and it was another medical student in our class, and they were like, I was really confused. This had never happened before, and I was just wondering if I was only hearing it at 2x speed. And I don't think it works that way.
Nope. Anyway.
Well, so I was on vacation. I couldn't fix it from where I was.
You just left it up?
No, I took it down, but it had already, you know, been downloaded, you know, 1,300 times or something like that.
Good.
So, you know, but I took it down and I re-released it 2 weeks ago. So, you know, if you got a little deja vu there, my apologies. It's just something that I do every once in a while, is accidentally forget to, because I edit at double speed. But anyway. Kay... This is the first one, is an email I got from someone whose name is the letter K.
You guys rock. I love your podcast. Aww. It's so great to listen to medical students being real people. It gives me hope that my life in medical school and beyond won't be a sleepless trail of tears as is portrayed by some other online resources. Both of my parents are addicts who got clean when I was 8 years old. I couldn't handle pre-med, so I switched majors and gave up on my dream of becoming a doc. When I got sober, I felt confident enough to try my hand at pre-med again. Since then, I've done really well and I've learned a lot about myself. I've been a part of Alcoholics Anonymous for 6 years, and the group dynamic, like you guys were talking about, has really changed my life. One of the biggest reasons I'm going back into medicine is that, through AA, I've discovered the joy of service and have gained the ability to relate to others. It's meant so much to me, but I am afraid I cannot talk about it. And worse than that, I'm afraid I'm entering a profession in which I will be forced to repress my truth. I love being free to express myself, and that's why I love what you guys are doing with the formation of the CCOM NAMI chapter.
Thanks for writing, Kay.
That was awesome.
That is your real name. What do you guys think about this? I mean, is she going to have to repress her true self?
Ooh, that's a good question.
I mean, the letter that she wrote was a long one, so I've compressed things a little bit, as you might have been able to tell, but one of the things that she did mention is that she's currently applying for medical school. And clearly her, you know, her newfound interest in service is very important to her, and she wants to talk about it. She probably wants to talk about why she got into it, what led her to that point. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a real conundrum. Like how much honesty should she include in that in that discussion. I know that, you know, there was some discussion about this during the actual show, and that it was, you know, it was a tough thing. Some people have tried to be very honest about it and gotten, you know, the short end of the stick on that. So what do you guys think?
Honest with, like, classmates and peers, or honest in, like, medical school interviews?
I'm going to say honest in medical school interviews and in her future life as a physician.
And if it were, okay, if it were up to me, that's really hard because I think honesty is really important in medical school interviews. But I know that substance abuse, especially like alcohol, is a tricky topic in terms of the medical profession, because substance abuse can be a problem in future physicians. I know that that's a reason why alcohol infractions are looked poorly upon from undergrad, just because it, I don't know, might be a problem for you down the road. So I don't know. It's a toss-up. But I think that in the future, when talking to patients, that could be a really positive thing to bring up. I think it would help build a good trusting relationship with them.
I think it also depends on the schools that you apply to. For me personally, when I applied, a lot of my work prior to, my situation was that I started college doing pre-med and then didn't do well, went back after college. I studied something else and then applied to medical school, and I was really involved in topics of reproductive health care and women's health. And so that, as much as I hate to say it, is very dicey. And so when I was applying, I just made sure to emphasize what I had gained from it that I thought was really important characteristics in a physician, and what I thought really needed to be done, and like how patients needed to be treated, and you know, dignity, respect. I just basically told them everything that I had learned and gained from it. And I think that speaks a lot to, it kind of takes away from like whatever issue is stigmatized, whatever is going on. And it basically lets you shine through and how far you've come and what you've gained. And I think that's really important.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like the, you know, like the job interview question where they ask you to name one of your weaknesses, and you know, almost everybody, the response is to spin it and turn one of your weaknesses into one of your strengths. And I think if you're going to go for the full honesty approach, that this is certainly one of those opportunities where, kind of like Irene was saying, you can just talk about everything that you've gained from your experience and from your perspective. They'll obviously see that you've turned things around as you're on the upward trend and improving greatly and on the right track. So that won't be an issue, that, you know, they'll see that things have straightened out. But I think that you have a perspective that not a lot of people have, who have picked up the pieces, you know, put them back together and giving it another shot. And you have a perspective that gives you a unique outlook on life, and also will prepare you uniquely for interacting with certain demographics of patients as well someday as a medical student and as a physician.
Totally. I totally agree with that. I think one of the most important things about physicians and up-and-coming physicians and physicians of our generation is that it's really important to be able to connect with people, and it's especially important if you've had that experience too. People connect with other people who've had certain experiences, and I think you can really go far connecting with your patients if you know what they're going through. It's pretty rewarding, I think.
I was just gonna kind of echo what they said, but like knowing, like walking into any interview knowing yourself and knowing what you're about, like they're like, the interviewers immediately know that. Like, yeah. Like they immediately read that. And it doesn't matter who you are, what your background is. You might step into an interview and you just don't click with a guy. And that has nothing to do with anything you've ever done.
Right.
Or you know, even them, maybe. It's just like, it's weird. So, I mean, I, like Irene, I kind of have a weird mixed background. So I was always like, well, I could walk into the room and this guy could be totally against any kind of war, and he's going to see Navy on my application and just toss me out. Or he's going to see my immigration work and he's going to toss me out. So I would just encourage you to be yourself. And you're not going to want to go to the place that turned you away because you're being honest.
Yeah.
I felt that way with my nose ring. totally different thing. But I said, if the school is not going to let me in because I leave my nose ring in, like, that's probably not the place for me. But kind of on the flip side of what I think a lot of you have said, I think the med school admissions process is probably not the biggest place for disclosure in your advocacy process. And I hope, I honestly hope that one day it will be, and that we can safely and securely and honestly have those conversations. But unfortunately, you know, things are changing, but the culture of med schools, thankfully not so much here at CCOM anymore, but a lot of places are not that way. When you're applying, there are so many qualified applicants, and to raise one red flag about yourself, unfortunately, could be the difference between your application getting put in the no pile versus the yes pile. And in such a non-transparent process, to have, you know, get the standardized rejection letter with no explanation of this is why we did it, you have no idea. Would it have been different had you written about something else? And I don't think that it has to be a full kind of an illusion of who you really are. Talk about some of the parts of your story, especially if they're adverse. Before coming to CCOM, I did a post-bac for disadvantaged or students from underserved areas. And so several of my classmates, and you know, my story is different too, and we all had things that we'd grown up in our past. I'm from California, so an area with a lot of gang problems, drug problems, teenage pregnancy, those sorts of things that come with lower socioeconomic status. And so people said, this is really a part of my story, this is who I am, this is part of my motivation for med school, how do I spin this? And one place on your application for that is the disadvantage statement. If you really have things like growing up with parents who weren't supportive or participating in your education because of addiction issues, and it's okay to spin that when talking about external factors in your life as opposed to your own struggles and spinning those how they've made you bigger. And that is an influence on why you want to do medicine, but maybe not so much a shining light on your own past history of those problems.
I'm glad you said that it's not the best place for a disclosure, because while I agree with everything everybody has said, you know, these people are human. And there's another factor to consider here, which is that at least at the Carver College of Medicine, there's a firewall between interviewer and the committee that selects people for entry into this medical school. And so you could, you know, fully disclose and generate a very positive impression with the interviewers. But when it comes to the committee that actually mm-hmm. considers your application, they're not necessarily going to have that benefit, other than, you know, maybe a strong recommend from the interviewers. They may see, you know, dependency and just, yep. you know, shut off, despite our best intentions, you know, and that's what scares me. And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to discourage you, Kay, from applying. I don't want to discourage you from being untrue to yourself. But what I do want to do is suggest that you, as Kylie said, you know, sort of downplay the negative, potentially negative seeming aspects, and upplay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Emphasize.
And emphasize what you got out of it, because people are people. People are human, and
there's always
prejudice.
People on the other end. Right. Like, that's what, and I would encourage anyone who is maybe concerned about this or worried about things like that, if you have schools that you really like and you plan on applying to, I would communicate with their admissions office before the heat of the application cycle, and like before you're totally in that. Talk to them, get to know them somehow, or like just communicate with them, because at the end of the day, I always felt really strongly, especially here at Carver, I kept in touch with them for a long time. There's people on the other end. They're going to tell you the truth. They're going to be very honest with you and very straightforward. And that's always appreciated when there's so many doubts and like, if you're going to get in, am I going to get in, all that stuff. So,
yeah. And I know we've talked a lot about the admissions process and interviewing and getting into school, but definitely once you're here, I think things are much more open. Mm-hmm. You know, you will form close friends, trusted individuals that you can share your status with. And that's a very important part mm-hmm. of being on the road to recovery, is having the support network and people to become accountability partners with you and to kind of journey on that, because it's kind of a long-term thing. And med school in no way is an easy path. It's definitely going to bring stuff up from your past. And when you are, you know, we sound all chipper here all the time, but when you haven't slept for 24 hours and you didn't do as well as you might have wanted to do, like, it does wear you down, you know, in kind of a fluctuating pattern. But the highs are great, but the lows are also low.
There was, but what about later? So, you know, you get into med school, you're successful, you get good grades, you know, pass with flying colors. Now you got to get into residency. You know, again, the topic you could be completely open about it. I know that, you know, I know of people who have been honest about it and have not gotten a residency position.
Yeah.
At least not right away. So there's the struggle there too.
I kind of feel like medical schools are even more holistic and accepting than residency interviews are, because
right.
I don't have, I guess, good evidence to back this up, but it's just the general feeling I've gotten that you really have to.
I think there's a good support system here and probably in other schools for students. And so, you know, there's still risk of, you know, of mental health issues being a problem during medical school, but there are support systems. Residency programs have a tougher time putting those kind of support systems together.
And residency is so much less about student development and so much more about its employment. It's a job. They're grooming you to perform a task, and people aren't there to kind of pat you on the back and give you time out. If you need to take a leave, your colleagues take on that extra work, and people see that as a liability.
Yeah, that's how it's perceived anyway. We talked about in the mental health show about how it shouldn't be that way. I mean, if you break your leg or you get a disease, you're going to be given time off. Well, it should be the same for mental health issues. It's sadly not. And again, there's strides being made, but not quick enough to probably to help you out right now. So I do want to get to Erica, who called in to praise us. Anyway, so first, Kay, good luck. Keep us posted. Let us know if you have any other questions, and we'll try to help you out.
Also, congratulations on getting over everything in your life. That's really, really impressive.
Yeah, it's must have been a lot of, must have been a long road, a lot of hard work, it sounds like. Good for you, Kay. I don't know if you're a man or a woman, by the way. So I chose a woman voice sort of at random among my small number of choices. So next, Erica called in to praise us.
Praise.
And ask a question about coping mechanisms.
Hey, Short Coast. My name's Erica. I'm calling from Boston. First of all, I love the podcast. I feel like I know all of you, which is kind of creepy, but also kind of cool. I just wanted to thank you for taking the time to speak so sincerely about mental health, which is so important. So one kind of question / comment. I certainly found that through my experiences with mental illness, I've learned a lot of empathy that I think will in fact make me a better physician in a lot of ways. But I've also learned a lot about myself and kind of, I guess, my triggers. Some of which being things like competition, comparison with others, not sleeping enough, you know, like isolating myself, studying too much. And I think a lot of those are things that are difficult to avoid in medical school and even residency. So I was wondering if you had any advice or tips on how to kind of insulate yourself from those things or to cope with them if they're truly unavoidable. Thank you so much. Have a great day. I look forward to hearing the podcast next week. Bye.
Thank you, Erica, for your question and for saying nice things about us. coping mechanisms. You guys are, you know, if Casey were here, she'd be able to address, you know, issues that come up later in medical education. But I think those things that she mentioned are more or less universal. They might get more intense or lesser intense. They might be more intense in one school and less intense at another. I know we do a pretty good job of being less competitive most times, unless you're talking about the all community Olympics.
War never changes.
I find it such an odd, I don't know, between you and me and the 18,000 people who download this episode, it seems like an odd dichotomy that we have this environment where we're like, oh, please don't, you know, please collaborate, please don't compete with each other, and for the most part you do, and then we have this community Olympics where we just sort of let it all hang out, like,
it starts tonight.
Yeah. There's absolutely no competition really in the classroom, but when it comes to making balloon towers, people will literally end friendships.
Oh my God.
I like to say when students ask about it, we are competitive in ways that don't matter.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And when we are competitive, it usually at the end, some charity benefits immensely because of how hard we're trying to beat each other.
Yes.
Awesome. That's awesome.
So I agree that, like, I have really not encountered a ton of, like a very competitive atmosphere here, and I think everybody is so awesome about it. But I think that a lot of the times it's just a personality trait to want to, you know, compare yourself against others and compete with others. And I know a few people that have, you know, struggled with that, especially when you're competing against ridiculously awesome people. Like, guys, some of the people that go to medical school, I'm straight up like, are you a real human? Do you sleep? Like, what are you? Are you a robot? Anyway, what I have found to really help me personally is to try to focus less on standardized things, like don't compare test scores, and focus more on the things that make you unique, that you can focus on. Like, for example, don't compare test scores, but work on something that you're very passionate about. Get very involved in a group. Build up your leadership capabilities in that aspect so that you can focus more on your differences instead of comparing yourself against the same things, if that makes sense.
I'll totally second that, Laura, that I feel like my biggest competition here is not external, but it's like within my own head, and the competition I create for myself between myself and those people I perceive to be, yeah, the like beyond human capable people. And on the topic of coping mechanisms, I was just telling someone the other day, I think my healthiest coping mechanism, although it's time intensive, I just, when I feel like too overwhelmed by school, I will literally go to Hogwarts and just reread the Harry Potter books. Read all 7 during neuro in the winter. Probably a bad time and a bad way to cope at that point. But some of the healthiest things that I've really held myself to coming out of undergrad, in which I never slept, was sleeping, you know, at least 6 hours, if not the full 8 hours. And it is incredible the difference it makes, not just for like retaining knowledge, but it stabilizes my mood and my perspective of things, because, you know, an untied shoelace after I have not gotten a good night's sleep will unhinge me. Like, it is, it just blows everything out of proportion. So sleeping and trying to eat healthy, exercise, you know, we hear those things all the time. But part of those things is that they can be done in community. And I still feel like I have friends and socializing, and I eat healthier when I'm around other people. And I'm, yeah, very, Kaylin's making a weird face. Then when
I know
I'm at
what
home,
she eats.
You know, we'll eat, a couple of us in here were just talking about like cosmic brownies. Shout out Little Debbie. Yeah. Can I do that? Can I shout out to Little Debbie?
Not a sponsor.
They are not a sponsor, but damn, I wish they were. So, yeah.
I mean, if you want to get in touch with us, Little Debbie.
Or just any Debbie. Any, we're always looking for
free,
feedback.
Free PR
any old
package.
Debbie will do.
Any Debbie that can bake me delicious sugar-filled snacks.
So anyway, back to
the I'm hungry.
Coping mechanisms.
Yeah, coping. I guess for me, it's always been two things. I've had a little bit more time outside of school than a lot of people, so I was able to kind of find things that I knew, kind of in the same vein that Laura said, things that were mine, just having something that is yours. Not even, it doesn't have to be a cause. It can be, you know, like, do you go crazy over Game of Thrones? That's your thing. Like, for me, it's getting to the gym and maybe knowing like 5 or 6 people who don't go to med school. So just having something that you can run to, maybe when somebody, you know, gets overly competitive and you just need to get out of there, like having something solid to turn to is really important. And then the thing that I knew that I wanted before I even moved to Iowa, I needed a group. I needed like a clan. And I found that. Found that and more. And
clan's a loaded word these days. I was going to say.
Sorry. I was like, clan is not the best.
How would you describe
a tribe?
How would you describe a
squad?
A squad, a posse.
Yeah.
A posse.
Okay, yes.
Excuse me. A posse. So I found that. And you just need to find the group of people that encourages you, that supports you, that knows kind of your baseline mood and is like, well, Kaylin's acting a little weird. You somebody go talk to her, you know, like, let's go buy her a pizza or, you know, a beer. Maybe she really needs it.
I want your friends.
And
I want people to buy me pizza and beer.
If you don't like people and your goal is med school so you can be a pathologist and you're like, oh, I don't want to be around people all the time because they are the source of my anxiety, get a pet. Pets in med school,
I was
Laura
just
can
gonna
this,
say that
are lifesavers. Not a dog. It's not fair to a dog, really, when you're in med school. But
hey.
Okay, you talk to him on your iPhone like all day.
Guys, I could do a literal 60-minute episode talking about my dog.
All right, Kylie's been trying to get me to do an episode on pets for a long time.
Oh my god!
If you listeners are wondering how can I like manage having pets in medical school, send Dave like blow up the inbox or the phone machine like message. What do you call those things?
The answering machine.
Yeah.
I literally have a reel to reel tape recorder in my office to record the voicemails.
Well, those. So I've been getting him to, for each person that has kind of different pets, ranging from like reptiles all the way up to 160-pound dogs here in med school, and kind of what that's like to both the stressful sides of it and the good sides of it. But those are other ways to kind of cope and step outside the classroom, and caring for something else definitely helps you take your mind off of your own situation for a little while.
Do you guys think that the comparison thing is a major source of stress?
Yes.
It's all internal, though. It really is.
It is internal.
I kind of agree. I mean, I've spoken to a bunch of people over the years who have had this sort of stress in their lives, you know, like worrying about, you know, am I doing as well as other people? Am I, you know, performing as well as other people? And I pretty much always say the same thing. You don't know what's going on with those people that you're comparing yourself to. You have no idea what their lives are like, because it's like Facebook. Nobody ever shows the bad things that are going on in their lives to everybody, you know? And so you may look at them and see a perfect person, but they're inside a seething cauldron of horror. And
jeez.
I mean, we all are, right?
Well, that escalated quickly.
Yes.
That is a good description.
Jeez. Or also TBT to MySpace when everybody would post really dramatic pictures of themselves like crying.
Did
I don't
you
know
say
if
TBT?
That was...
You had weird friends.
No.
People post.
Oh, guys, come on. MySpace was seriously so dramatic.
It was during the peak
emo phase, you know, with like the heavy eyeliner. And
we should bring that back.
Yeah. Anyway.
MySpace or the emo phase?
What's that?
Is it MySpace or the emo phase?
The emo phase, I meant. Not
I had
mine.
A Zanga. I had to email the company to get rid of my account before I applied to medical school because it was the first thing that came up when you Googled my name.
What?
It was so awful.
That was the OG.
I was like 13 or 14. Aww.
But getting back to the... talking about the competition thing, I think a lot of it stems from people who get to medical school being very high achievers, being very goal oriented, and constantly, you know, given that positive reinforcement of good grades gets me farther, gets me toward whatever my goal might be right now, which, you know, for a lot of people in the pre-med is getting to medical school. And then you get to medical school with 150 odd other people just like you, just as high achieving, and now all of a sudden it's this mismatch of expectations where, you know, you're coming from an institution, you may have been toward the top, and now you are, you know, maybe coming out dead average every time. And that can be a struggle for people to adjust to, because for a lot of people that success was their source of self-identity, and now that self-identity is at a crisis.
I like to tell people to decide ahead of time before you come to medical school. Decide ahead of time what you're going to call success. And don't include in that grades or test scores or things like that. Those things are, to some extent, important, but you need to have other reasons to call yourself successful. So decide what those are going to be, and then use those as your yardsticks. If you gotta have something to strive for, if you are goal oriented and need something to strive for those things, and maybe let the grades become secondary.
Yeah, when I'm really feeling like the comparison is bad, or like, oh, I wish I had done better on that test, like, oh, I'm just average. To clear those thoughts from my head, I don't remember where I've heard it, but someone said it's like really hard to be miserable when you have an attitude of like gratefulness. And so one thing for us last year during our first year was walking out of a Friday exam and being like, ugh, and then immediately seeing the glass room full of interviewing medical students and telling myself, wow, okay, I'm average. But when I was coming into medical school, my biggest fear was not passing, not making the cut here. And I'm doing more than fine. And I am surrounded by great people. And I have overcome like so much to be achieving my goals. Like, I love this med school. There are so many reasons to be grateful. And then it kind of resets my brain as to like, okay, you're focusing on the minute stuff that does not matter for your day-to-day life, or the big picture.
So let's move on to residency, because that was one of the components of your question. How do you avoid stress in residency? None of us are experts on that, unfortunately.
Hey, I have matched with a few residents on Bumble. I like to think I know what their life is about.
I'm dating a resident. Does that
count? Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I suppose it does. Does your husband...
Boyfriend.
Gee, get a hint.
Once again, that escalated quickly.
Sorry. Does your boyfriend experience stressors that he has particular coping mechanisms, or do you just come home and yell?
I feel bad talking about
it. Well, you don't have to. We can cut
off. No,
this.
No, it's
does
okay.
He listen?
No.
Well, that shouldn't be the yardstick. That's hardly ethical.
I will say that I think the one thing I will say, I don't want to disclose anything without, you know, him knowing about it. But I will say that he does, I think, like things to be consistent. Mm-hmm. And so when you're in a resident schedule, you have very, just like medical school, you have very limited time. And so making time for things and scheduling things and being consistent with your schedule, I think, is a really good way to keep from...
My boyfriend also just started residency in July, and his kind of outlet is just talking to somebody about it. Like, he's a talker. By the way, he listens to the show and he wants to come on it so bad, and I keep having to tell him, no, I'm so sorry, you can't come on, you're not a medical student. Anyway, yeah, he really likes to talk things out, and he also has a dog. So, Kylie... Turns out you can have dogs in the medical profession, guys.
You and Vivek are great dog parents.
So, Erica, also, best of luck. Don't compare yourself to other people. Pick your metric as far as what success is. And also, get enough sleep, I think, and eat right. There we go. Coping mechanisms right there.
Drink awesome. Sometimes.
And don't drink to excess. How about that? All right. Hey, listen, big news in cancer. Huge. From the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, we get some groundbreaking research that says that alternative medicine kills patients because it does nothing. I know. They studied 34 million records of cancer patients from the National Cancer Database. They compared patients who rejected conventional treatments like chemo, radiation, surgery, in favor of alternative medicine. After 5 years, 78.3% of subjects who received conventional treatments were still alive versus 54.7% of subjects who use alternative medicine.
What alternative medicines?
They don't know.
What?
Because that's not a part of the medical record. I mean, once they leave the medical system, those things aren't recorded. Mm. They do address that lack of knowledge by saying that, well, if I understand correctly, well, we kind of know these things don't work, so it doesn't matter which ones they chose. Mm. But as long as we know they were choosing alternative medicine, that's a good enough metric right there. I don't know. I don't. I'm not knowledgeable enough to tell whether that's actually a valid thing. But I thought this was interesting. Breast cancer patients who used alternative medicine were 5 times more likely to die. Colorectal patients were 4 times more likely to die if they chose alternative medicine. Interestingly, prostate cancer patients were only slightly more likely to die, and the difference wasn't statistically significant. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts about that? Why that would be?
I have 2 thoughts. First of all, this is kind of a tangent. I just got in a fight with a stranger on Facebook. In one of my Facebook groups, it's a dog nutrition Facebook group.
And we're back.
It's called, it's called a Dog Food Nerds of Facebook, if you're interested.
Wow.
It's quite interesting.
That is very specific. Okay.
Yeah, it's great, guys. Anyways, there was this, there's actually like a lot of people in there that are into like natural things. She was trying to say that coconut oil like helps with diabetes and like reduces cancer rates. And I just,
yeah, no. We recently heard the study that's not true either, that coconut oil is kind of bad for you.
Yeah, coconut oil like isn't that great. It's just not. Yeah. Like it's, people are just like, oh, it's so natural and healthy, but it's just a fat pretty much. Anyway, where I was going with this was,
I put it in my hair. Makes it fun.
Well, that's okay.
Okay, fair. I looked it up on this website that we have access to called Natural Medicines. I don't know if you guys, it's super cool. You can look up any supplement on there and it'll show you like clinical trials that have been done based on it. It's like evidence-based. Really cool. I looked up coconut oil and it has like moderate evidence that it helps with helps topically with eczema. So
remember you were going to talk about pancreatic cancer? No. Or something?
Prostate.
Oh, shoot.
Very different.
Sorry. I'm mixed total organ systems there.
Anyway, the moral of that story is that I generally very much believe in traditional medicine, but I also was watching this documentary, or maybe it was a news article or something, about this baby that was born with cancer. And I think this was back in the 90s. There weren't very good treatments out against it, and they were like, you can either treat the kid and it's going to be really hard because it's literally giving chemo to a newborn baby, or just do nothing and chance the kid dying. And they did nothing and the cancer miraculously went away. So those are just really 2 interesting stories that were really tangentially related. And
it's what we do here, Laura.
Okay. And then one other thing I have to say, and then I'll be done, guys. I'm sorry. I'm taking over today. The rates of survival for the alternative medicine in the study that you were talking about, like, are kind of high, it sounds like.
I mean, more than 50%.
Yeah, that's a lot higher than I was expecting.
Isn't prostate cancer, or certain prostate cancers, I'm not really sure.
It's really not aggressive.
Isn't it one of those things, I'm reading about this on a New York Times article, called More Men with Early Prostate Cancer Are Choosing to Avoid Treatment, and talking about how a large proportion of them will do active surveillance. So I think there's something specific and unique to prostate cancer.
It's a lot more slow growing and less metastatic, I think. Is that correct?
It can, like, certain people can get aggressive prostate cancer that, remember, it metastasizes to the lumbar vertebrae, but
yeah, it is. But it, there are like anything, there are much more aggressive isoforms.
Yeah,
but
it's one of, like, I think the less aggressive, slow-growing cancers, and tends to have an older age of onset. So I know a lot of men will typically get diagnosed in even their 80s and 90s and choose not to treat, just because they know that something else will likely kill them before this prostate cancer.
Yeah.
It's also quite easy to monitor because there's the lab test prostate-specific antigen, and you can just kind of monitor that. And then when it starts, you know, suddenly going up, you know, things might be getting bad.
Casey, you made it.
I made it.
Yay.
I decided to offload a little bit of your pressure for overscheduling people.
That was nice of you.
Casey also has a pet in medical school.
I do have a pet in medical school.
Bearded dragon.
Yeah. Were we talking about pets without me? Are you kidding me
right
now?
There was a brief moment where we discussed.
For stress.
Oh, yeah. I have a bearded dragon. It was the ring bearer in my wedding ceremony. And
how did it get there? Did you, like, I'm just so curious.
We put it on a pillow and our friend carried it down the aisle.
So your friend didn't get to be the ring bearer. It had to carry the ring bearer.
Yeah, no, okay. She had to carry the actual ring bearer.
More questions, though. Was this like a small fancy pillow or like a body pillow?
No, it was a... It's not that big. It was a...
Did it take two people?
It's actually
a
Komodo
small,
dragon.
Fancy pillow. Yeah, we walked it on a leash.
Did you put a tiny bow tie on it?
I made a little vest for it. I'm so glad I came by. They're very good pets, though. They're very chill. They're friendly to humans. They've got sharp little talons, but that just means they can hang from your shirt. They don't use them for anything mean.
Does it help you cope with stress?
It does. It does. He sits in my living room, and I look at him, and I go, aww, you're the best little cricket murderer ever, and I love you. You're such a monster, yes.
What is his name?
Olivarion.
Oh, Ollie.
Yeah. Oh, we should call him Ollie. No. It's a combination
what,
of...
What, that never occurred to you? Okay.
We just call him the dragon most of the time.
Oh, okay.
But technically his name is Olivarion, because I wanted to name him after John Oliver, but Tony wanted it to be Game of Thrones sounding.
That is Game of Thrones
it
sounding.
It is. Yeah, it really is.
First thing I thought of.
So we compromised.
Well, all right. Before we...
Sorry, I hijacked right. that.
I just crashed your party, like, real hard.
You did. I did want to mention one other thing from the study that I found interesting. The study noted that the patients getting the alternative therapies were more likely to be, and I find this weird, younger, wealthier, well-educated, and have fewer comorbidities. Well, the fewer comorbidities problem I don't have a problem with because they were younger and all that kind of stuff. But well-educated people I don't expect to be going in for, you know... alternative therapy. I don't know. Maybe I'm just a jerk by saying that.
That probably explains the high survival rates in that group.
This is also similar to the group that doesn't vaccinate their children. Some of these really educated parents that think they know more and are invincible.
Yeah, never mind.
Did they not do a regression?
I'm full of shit. What I'm trying to say is that I mean, thinking that why would well-educated people feel like, you know, alternative therapies were better than medicine? Well, because well-educated people are stupid. It's
and
true.
They can afford stupid. It. Yeah, they can afford to try alternative therapies. Right.
You just looked at me stricken, Kylie.
I thought when I brought up the anti-vax thing that you were like starting to violently steer this in another direction.
Oh, no.
I thought
no,
so
no,
too.
Certainly not.
Look of fear on Dave's face. No.
No, no, no. One unanswered question for me is it better than nothing? Treatment that was not studied, so that would be that might be interesting. I don't
Maybe.
Know how you would study that because
you could speak to
ethically.
I mean,
yeah, ethically no. It would be a problem.
I guess you could speak to how people feel about actively psychologically how they feel about actively engaging in some sort of treatment form, and maybe they feel like it's really helping them. Maybe they and I feel like your state of mind can also
well,
but I don't know.
They're apparently wrong.
Okay.
It's not helpful.
I feel like maybe the data would be out there for people who elected for alternative therapy versus people who just elected to do nothing. Maybe
yeah.
that could be a comparison, like a retrospective case study.
We'll get on that. You have your next research project for the summer if you want to beat yourself.
I already got one, Dave.
If you want to beat
Dave.
Yourself over that summer research thing
yeah.
again.
Next summer. The summer that is 10 months away. Of
you
the summer
do it,
that we
Dave.
Get 1 week off.
Yeah, y'all don't get a summer. You're done.
I'm not doing any more.
RIP to summers.
Well, one more thing we can talk about this week. Organ transplants.
Ooh.
Come a long way. But one problem has proven difficult to fix, which is the availability of organs for transplantation. So for a long time now... I don't know if you could hear that, but she was making pig noises.
Is that, like
is that what it is?
Yeah.
Is
pig
it
organs?
For a long time
pig
now...
Pig organs?
Yeah, so for a long time now, getting organs from animals has been kind of a tantalizing solution to the problem because what? We don't love animals as much as we love people, apparently, and we don't have any problem killing
exactly.
them off so that we, will live longer. But anyway... What? There are two issues with animal transplantation. First, obviously, rejection, always a problem. The second is that, at least for pig organs, which are a good fit for human transplantation, otherwise, pigs are filled with viral DNA that could affect their organ's new hosts.
Yep.
But now, we have CRISPR. And for the first time, Chinese researchers at
CRISPR is like the invention of our generation.
It's like
oh, yeah.
the cool kid on the block.
And
it is
and
so cool.
Most people haven't heard of it, but it's going to change everything.
It's already changing everything. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
Yep. Literally changing everything.
So the first... for the first time, Chinese researchers at a startup called eGenesis have been able to use it to knock out porcine endogenous retroviruses, amusingly called pervs.
Kylie, get your hands out of your pants.
Oh, speaking of pervs.
So, quick, hit her with
my
the CRISPR.
My hands get cold.
Okay. Well, of the 37 live births, 15 survived, and they're of a breed which is just the right size to make human organs that fit, or that human-sized organs that fit into adult humans. So that's amazing. Those 15 could go on to sire many more little baby pigs that have human-compatible organs.
15 is, though, like, significantly less than half surviving.
Yeah, but I mean, the point is that they did. I think this is how breeding works. I mean, you breed in a hope that you get viable animals, and then from those viable animals, since they're already viable, they may be able to pass on those that viability to future generations, and then you have a whole.
Plus, like, if a pig can't even make that basic, you know, staying alive on its own bar, I don't know that I want its organs like in me.
Yes.
You know, so maybe they're doing us a favor by just not surviving.
Thank you for failing, baby pigs.
So taking one for the team.
And that immunocompatibility thing is also being whittled away. Another team has knocked out genes that make a molecule called alpha-gal, which is one of the proteins implicated in the human immune response to xenotransplants. Interesting fact about alpha-gal. Do you know this? If you get bitten by a certain tick that carries alpha-gal, you'll become allergic to meat.
Yeah,
what?
I did know that because there's
did
a
know that.
There's a This American Life about it.
I think
Which
it's another
it?
Related show though.
It's the saddest thing I've ever
Radio
heard.
Lab?
Yeah, it might be Radio,
Radio
Lab.
It might be Radio Lab.
Yeah.
Allergic to meat.
I think it's the Lyme disease tick. It's like Ixodes.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly.
Ixodes.
Yeah. One of them their ticks.
Sketchy micro.
Yep.
Kaylin and I are having silent arguments across the room about which of us is an alpha gal.
I think everybody else knows.
I think Kaylin is because she's a Navy girl.
Since day one, Kaylin and I have argued about who would win in a fight. It came close.
A physical
volleyball.
Fight?
Yeah.
You tackled me while I was going after a ball.
Well,
is that
get them while they're not suspecting. I have no problem hitting her while she's down. You should probably edit that out.
It's not.
No,
we could tie this back to our competition discussion.
I will pay good student loan money to see this fight.
I don't condone violence.
It'll happen sometime.
Better than pay-per-view.
And that is our show.
And Dave's lost control.
I wanted to sing Let Me Smang It, Girl. Oh. Dave promised me I could do karaoke.
All right, go ahead.
Well, now I have
some. Oh, okay. All right. That is our show. Guys, thank you so much for taking the time to hang out with me. And thank you, listeners, for making us part of your week. If you like what you heard today, I'm begging you to leave us reviews on iTunes. Reviews help us grow the show. But more importantly, it helps us feel good about what it is we are doing here on a Friday. If you don't like what you heard today, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know, because we love it. Or if you have a suggestion for something we should talk about or seek barely informed, sleep-addled advice, you could send those things to shortcoats@gmail.com or leave us a message at 347-SHORT-CT. The show is made possible by a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine Student Government and the Writing Humanities Program. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our opening music is by Dr. Vox, and our closing music is by Argo Agrofox.
Oh my God, Dave's having a stroke.
Agrofox.
Argo Fox. Don't know what to do.
Talk to you in 1 week.
Wait, I got it. How you like your pigs, genetically modified. The way you harvest organs has got me mesmerized.
That's good, guys. That's really good.